pleasure to be with you. I'll be back again next Wednesday. Peace.
Welcome to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tom Johnston in Adelaide. Today on The Wire.
I don't think anyone would suggest that Jesus, the man who the Catholic Church professes to follow most closely, would say that you should protect a child abuser at the expense of the child.
Lifting the lid on the church confessional and
get them to sit up and take notice by bringing litigation, which sort of puts the issue in a more concrete context, I guess, because they're going to face a lawsuit and have to go to court to explain their decisions.
Climate change isn't just bad for the environment, it's bad for business. Also on the show, are ER egos affecting patient care? And is depression an affliction of the West? Stay tuned for these stories and more on The Wire. First, we've got Sarah Martin from the newsroom to update us on the latest from today. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Tom.
The city of Yarra has today received some backlash after dropping references to Australia Day.
Yes, the city of Yarra has followed on from yesterday's report. The council was warned by the federal government not to scrap Australia Day, and the Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull says he's deeply disappointed with the decision.
And it looks like infamous Australian terrorist Khaled Sharouf might have been killed in an airstrike in Syria.
That's right. Law enforcement has reportedly seen a photo evidence that was shared amongst the extremist community. What makes this is interesting is that it might be the first case of Australian children being killed by a Western airstrike in the Syrian conflict. Questions will now be asked about what role Australia had in the deaths. Mr. Sharouf has been on the scene since 2004 when he was jailed for 5 years as a peripheral player in a terrorist conspiracy. He moved to Syria to fight for IS in 2013, yet it was this year that his and many others had their citizenship stripped.
Although Barnaby Joyce has renounced his New Zealand citizenship, it's still quite a hot topic in Australian politics.
True. A censure called on Penny Wong by the coalition government has been unsuccessful, yet it looks to have successfully raised the tension between the government, the opposition and the New Zealand government. To censure was moved accusing Senator Wong of attempted to undermine the government of Australia after she had informal discussions with Labor counterparts in New Zealand over Deputy PM Barnaby Joyce's dual citizenship.
And American President Donald Trump has said a bit more about the rallies in Charlottesville.
That's right. After a car drove into an anti-racism protest, killing one and leaving 35 injured, Trump condemned hatred, bigotry and violence, but was far from naming any specific groups. Since then, he continued to open up, putting blame on both anti-racism protesters and the white supremacists. It seems, however, taking the middle ground might only be hammering in the stake between a very divided America.
And after months of political deadlock, the government's attempt to shake up media ownership and regulation might actually go through.
That's right. One Nation leader Pauline Hanson's announced a conditional support. Her decision is based on an agreement to investigate the ABC's balance and commitment to rural areas, as well as call for transparency over wages. One thing's for sure, if One Nation strike a deal with the coalition, we might see some big changes at ABC and SBS.
Enjoying the show? Tell us about it on Twitter with the hashtag TheWireRadio.
The Royal Commission into Institutional Response to Child Sexual Abuse has handed down its 85 recommendations to prevent the sexual abuse of children in institutional environments. One recommendation in particular has caused quite a stir within the Catholic Church, with the Royal Commission recommending that clergymen should be held accountable if they do not report instances of child sexual abuse revealed in the confessional. Several Catholic leaders have spoken out against the recommendation, saying that the sacredness of the confessional should remain untouched. Mr. Peter Gogarty is a sexual abuse survivor and lecturer in criminology at Newcastle University. He told The Wire's Sam Bradbrook that lifting the seal of the confessional will benefit victims of child sexual abuse.
A lot of people think that what we're talking about potentially is somebody in the community who wanders into the confessional and says to the priest that, you know, forgive me, Father, I've sinned and I've molested a child. I think that's one issue that is probably being focused on a little bit too much at the moment. The bigger risk to our children, I think, is for one priest who is molesting children to be confronted by another priest, one of his colleagues, or his bishop, and says, look, Father Fred, I think you might be interfering with children. And that priest then says, forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. And the person who is receiving that confession then has their hands tied. And I think that is what has got the Catholic Church into a great deal of trouble over the last few decades. And the other point that I'd make is that Australia is a secular community. We certainly have freedom of religion and freedom of religious expression, but I don't think anyone would suggest that Jesus, the man who the Catholic Church professes to follow most closely, would say that you should protect a child abuser at the expense of the child.
So you do think that these recommendations will help catch out more offenders?
Absolutely. I think what they'll do is help identify more offenders, and it increases the likelihood that those offenders will be prosecuted for their crimes. Because at the moment, because our system is so determined to be fair to anyone who's accused, there's a lot of loopholes that a pedophile can use to extract themselves from a prosecution. So we've had examples in recent years. One that is particularly prominent was a Maris brother who was convicted, I think, in 2015 of molesting a child. What nobody in the community knew until after that conviction was that he'd had 8 previous trials about 8 different children, and in every case the jury was told that there were no other complainants, that this man had been accused of molesting this one child, and because the jury didn't have any of that information, he was acquitted on 8 occasions. Under the recommendations proposed by the Royal Commission, that situation would be different.
Some high-profile priests and members of the church have come out recently and said that they would rather face jail time than lift the seal of the confessional. Do you think that this is proof of the church's resistance to change?
I really do. I think this is very much evidence that the Catholic Church still sees itself as beyond the reach, if you like, of our secular law in this country. And it's about time somebody said, this is a secular country, we do have laws, and you will obey them, and you will not avail yourselves of an excuse that we have a higher authority that lets us ignore your laws. I think it's very, very important that the Catholic Church learns that it is no longer calling the tune on these issues.
And an alternative suggested is that clergymen recommend that abusers that confess turn themselves into the authorities. Is this just clergymen palming off the issue?
Yeah, it really is. I heard one yesterday in the media somewhere saying if someone confessed to him, he would say, well, I won't absolve you of your sin unless you go to the secular authorities. But effectively, what it's doing is still giving people in high places in the Catholic Church, people with the knowledge of sexual abuse, still gives them a get-out-of-jail-free card, quite literally. They can conceal the crime of a pedophile and get away with it. And that would not wash with anyone else from any other denomination or any other area of our community. If you know that someone's committing one of these crimes, you're obliged to do something about it.
And just finally, comparing your own experiences with fighting for justice, do you think the process will be better or worse for victims after the Royal Commission?
I think it will be enormously better. And my biggest hope, and the thing that I have fought most for over the last 15 or so years, is that children won't be put into this predicament ever again, that they won't be abused in the first place. And that if something does happen, that the people who know that it's happening will do something about it quickly, because it's now very, very evident that a pedophile does not stop. They can't be cured. They can't choose to stop. So somebody who abuses a child today is likely to do it again next month and next year and will continue on as long as they're healthy. So
I think what the recommendations of the Royal Commission will do is stop all of those people in their tracks, and it will stop the people who were enabling that sort of abuse to continue to think twice before they decide to ignore what they know is going on.
Child sexual abuse survivor and lecturer in criminology at Newcastle University, Mr. Peter Gogarty, concluding that interview with The Wire's Sam Bradbrook.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
In Venezuela, cases of malaria are predicted to triple by the end of the year. But in the 1960s, the country prided itself on being free from the diseases. So where did they go wrong? Senior lecturer at the University of Sydney, Dr. Luis Ferrandez, told The Wire's Nicole Wedding why malaria is on the rise.
The spread of malaria has to do with elements that are associated with the economic crisis. Indications show is that the spread is really due to larger mobility of labor within the country and basically the search for economic activities or income has led many people to come back or to go to mines in remote areas of the country in which malaria had a presence. This mobility of people has actually contributed not only to spread malaria, the epidemics within these areas, but as well to bring malaria back to the host towns and the hometowns of people traveling. This seems to be basically, therefore, an epidemic that has to do as well with economic factors.
And how does the politics of the country play into this?
Medicines are really in shortage at the moment in the country. There is really a very strong external debt at the moment conditioning the amount of money that the public treasury can dedicate, for instance, imports of medicines. There is not really a capacity at the moment by other private actors to increase that level.
What has been your experience of the Venezuelan healthcare system?
I lived in the country for many years, but I was there last time in this time in November last year, 2016. Thankfully, I didn't have used medical services, neither there nor elsewhere. The current state of health provision, of course, has been subjected to a deterioration, which has to do with the general economic crisis. Unfortunately, the country really is going through a period in which the public treasury is suffering heavily from a decrease of income, and that affects public expenditure. So certainly the achievements that previous governments had over the past 16 years in the area of health provision in some cases have been eroded by the current crisis. And in some cases, people who have the economic means can obtain, for instance, medicine in the black market. For those with limited economic resources, is becoming not only a problem to access quality health services, but as well to obtain certain medicines.
What do you think could be done to resolve this?
Only a sort of medium-term economic recovery can prevent this mobility of people seeking for economic alternatives in different parts of the country. As far as people feel the necessity to engage, for instance, mining activities in certain parts of the country because there are no other sources of income in their areas of residence, we are going to see that there are more probabilities of the epidemics spreading. Beyond that, there is not really an easy solution. Of course, what would be desirable is that there is more support, and in this case, I think some international support would be welcome for the arrival of medicines in Venezuela, because there are otherwise a lot of people suffering an illness that is potentially lethal and do not have any other alternatives.
Dr. Luis Ferrandez, senior lecturer at the University of Sydney, speaking to The Wire's Nicole Wedding. For years, people have been concerned about the environmental impact of climate change on the planet. But could it also be bad for business? The Wire's Bonnie Parker reports.
Last week, the Commonwealth Bank of Australia were taken to federal court for allegedly failing to disclose the financial risks climate change poses to their business interests. The case is the first of its kind in the world and was filed by Environmental Justice Australia on behalf of two of the Commonwealth Bank's shareholders. David Barnden is a lawyer from Environmental Justice Australia. I spoke to him after the proceedings were filed.
The claim alleges that the bank should have disclosed climate change risks as a major or material risk to investors, and we asked the court to ensure that the bank doesn't make those same omissions in the future.
The Commonwealth Bank responded to the filing of legal proceedings, saying that they take their statutory reporting obligations seriously and reject the idea that the report is not compliant with those obligations. Since then, the bank's released its first climate policy position statement. So how is climate change a financial risk? And are banks and other companies obliged to outline their climate change risks? Jacqueline Peel is a professor of law at the University of Melbourne. She says in recent years, climate change has shifted from being seen as just an environmental or ethical issue to a financial risk.
This issue depends on the laws of each country, and in Australia, the law at the moment is unclear. So there are laws that require companies to make certain kinds of disclosures in their annual reports and annual financial reports, and usually that kind of disclosure is limited to material financial risks, things that are going to affect investment decisions, things that shareholders will take into account in planning and looking at the value of a particular investment. So at the moment, it's not entirely clear as a legal matter whether that idea of material financial risk also extends to climate change risk in Australia, and this case that's being brought is really trying to test that issue, building off this momentum in the scientific area and in the international legal arena to say, well, look, we've reached the point now where climate change is not just an ethical issue, it's not just an environmental issue, it's a financial risk issue that companies need to take into account and be transparent with their shareholders and investors about.
It's the first time shareholders have taken a bank to court for allegedly failing to disclose climate change risks. What other similar cases have there been?
So there's been cases in the United States, as you'd expect. They do a lot of litigation, so that's where we've seen the first cases emerging. Those cases have been a combination of regulatory investigations, so attorney generals in particular states, California and New York, taking forward actions against companies with a particular focus on coal and oil companies like Peabody Coal, which is a big coal miner in the US, and Exxon. There's recently been a shareholder action brought against Exxon, and that's really shareholders saying that the failures of Exxon around how it discloses climate risk and how that will affect particular assets that Exxon holds and how it values those assets is going to lead to loss in value of the shareholders' shares, and therefore they want Exxon to be more transparent about these issues. There's also some regulatory complaints that have been brought in the UK, again against big energy companies. So there's this international push through those two jurisdictions to try and get companies to do more on telling investors and shareholders about what sorts of risks they face from climate change.
Do you see taking legal action as an effective way to make companies more transparent and accountable?
Well, certainly that's the kind of change theory that groups like the Environment Justice Australia are working on, that the litigation or threat of bringing a lawsuit might make companies rethink some of their policies around climate change. And a lot of the groups that bring this kind of litigation in the US, in Australia and elsewhere are really trying to produce social change, produce behavioural change by companies, get them to sit up and take notice by bringing litigation, which sort of puts the issue in a more concrete context, I guess, because they're going to face a lawsuit and have to go to court to explain their decisions.
Jacqueline Peel, Professor of Law at the University of Melbourne, finishing that report from The Wire's Bonnie Parker. Emergency departments are known for being stressful environments, but did you know some doctors and nurses are bullied every day? That's according to a new survey conducted by the Australasian College for Emergency Medicine, the ACEM. The Wire's Catherine Andrews asked emergency physician and president-elect of the ACEM board, Dr. Simon Judkins, how he felt about the survey's results.
Obviously very confronting and very concerning figure. I mean, one out of three doctors having been impacted by bullying, adding to that the discrimination and the harassment issues that also arose, it really made us deeply concerned, I think, for the welfare of some of our junior doctors, and that we need to do a much better job in actually raising these issues or highlighting these issues and finding some solutions.
Why did you decide you wanted to be a doctor in an emergency department?
Emergency medicine is such a team-based game, and everybody's very, very supportive of each other. But it's also an incredibly stressful environment. So you do find, I suppose, that sometimes in more stressful environments, some of these behaviours tend to manifest. But that's no excuse. And we have found from other surveys that this seems to be a problem across public and private hospitals generally. So there's a real problem with medical culture generally and the way we train our doctors and the pressure we put our junior doctors and each other under.
Have you ever experienced workplace bullying from other doctors or nurses?
Probably more in my junior days, when I think I was probably less confident and probably questioned my abilities a lot more as I was training. I look back now and realise that some of the behaviours from my senior colleagues and certainly some of the nursing staff were just playing with things like bullying and harassment, yeah.
Why do you think there is this culture of bullying in emergency departments or hospitals? Shouldn't a doctor or nurse's first priority be the safety and wellbeing of their patients?
So if your staff feel harassed, distressed, burnt out, unsafe, or not in an environment where they can perform to the, you know, their maximum capacity or ability, that will have impacts on patient care. And so we need to understand that the flow and effects of this sort of culture directly impacts our capacity to be able to look after our patients properly.
What advice would you give a doctor or a nurse who's experiencing workplace bullying every day?
One of the issues is that they need to actually call out bad behaviour. And this is, you know, and that's easy to say, because one of the things that was really concerning for me is that people recognised bad behaviour, but they didn't feel confident or didn't know where they could go to actually report this behaviour. The solution is what we need to work on now. We need to put really sort of robust systems in place to give people confidence that it's actually okay to call out bad behaviour, and it's okay, you know, to look after yourself and look after your colleagues. That's going to be part of what we need to actually address the problem.
President-elect of the ACEM board, Dr. Simon Judkin, speaking with The Wire's Catherine Andrews. Is depression and unhappiness a disease of the West? Brock Bastian, Associate Professor of the University of Melbourne, is trying to find out.
Certainly, some people have questioned or queried whether or not it's just a matter of measurement. You know, can we measure depression in the same way across these cultures? But increasingly, I think that people are recognising that measurement issues can't explain all of these differences away. So there's probably a number of very important cultural differences which matter here. But I think the key ones have to do with how people respond to their negative emotions. People in Eastern cultures report just as much negative emotion, you know, sadness and things like this, but they don't seem to go on to develop clinical disorders associated with that emotion, like depression or anxiety. Well, they do, but just not to the same rates as people in the West. So it's not that people in the East aren't experiencing the same sort of emotions. You would expect, you know, it would be kind of weird if they didn't. You know, we're all experiencing the same emotions. We're just responding to them differently. And I think that one of the reasons that the West, you know, in the West we respond badly to our negative emotions is that we see them as interrupting this sort of perceived goal of needing to be happy all of the time. So if you think that it's important to be happy in life, when you feel sad, you feel like you're failing to meet that prescribed social goal, which makes you respond to that sadness in worse ways.
So how can recognising these kinds of like culturally specific aspects be used to work toward treatment of depression?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think first it's very important to understand the influences on human behaviour, and I think if you're trying to understand yourself, if you're trying to understand why why you feel the way that you do, then part of that is also understanding what contributes to that, and sometimes understanding that, you know, that the cultures we live in may be in part influencing us in detrimental ways like this. It's important to I guess make people feel less responsible for sometimes the way that they do respond to their negative emotions or the way that they do feel. So it's understanding that. I think understanding is a very, very big part of psychotherapy. It's, you know, providing insight into these factors, which is very important to help people to deal with them. Of course, you know, we can't just get up and change the culture we live in very easily. That takes time and, well, you know, sometimes we have very little influence over that at all. But at least knowing and understanding the sources and the way that information from the culture perhaps influences us is a very important, you know, pathway to understanding why we feel the way we do, why we think the way we do, why we respond the way we do. And then we can adjust that with that new knowledge in mind.
So would you say things like social media, for example, having an impact on the way that people understand their own happiness?
It's the case of social media. There's a real panacea of happy faces there, and we tend to all participate in that. You know, we very rarely post a photo of ourselves looking glum, you know, we like to present a particular kind of side of ourselves on social media, and so that can be mistaken, I think, easily for feeling that, you know, that everyone is always feeling this way, and then why aren't we always feeling that way? So yeah, I mean, in a sense, social media is presenting one side of ourselves, the happy side, the sort of positive side, the successful side. And to the extent that we're not communicating the other side of ourselves, then that seems that very quickly, even in a very sort of unconscious sort of way, can start to influence people and lead them to see that or feel that other people around them are far more happy, are far more successful, are far more enjoying life far more than they are. When in fact, you know, again, they're probably having those same experiences. They're just not communicating on social media. They're not making those things as public, I suppose, as the culturally salient, happy kinds of experiences they may be having.
Associate Professor Brock Bastian ending that report by The Wire's Bonnie Parker. That's it for The Wire today. I'm Tom Donston from Radio Adelaide. Thanks for your company.
It's not just about people in barrels, so shut up.
What the hell?
Plenty of interesting banter to offer up right here on 2SER.
Oh.